the Welcome to Fatherhood podcast. I'm your host. My name is Kelly, and I'm here to remind you, however you're listening and wherever you're listening, that as dads, we're just like moms. Except we're dads. Ha ha!
Hi, folks. I'm Steve Manchester. I'm a published author. I've been at it for quite a few years, probably 30 in total. 17 of my books have actually, you know, gone on to Amazon. We have seven national bestsellers. So in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, we've really done pretty well. And I'm super excited about the new book that's coming out in September called Dad, a Novel. And equally grateful to be on with you today, Kelly.
So give me a little bit of more background of who you are as a person, father, husband, grandfather. Where are you at in life right now?
I'm in a good place, and I'm grateful for it. Believe me, I count my blessings every day. I'll go back real quick. I come from a town called Westport, Massachusetts, which is on the coast, probably about 60 miles south of Boston. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, my grandfather was an amazing storyteller. And his nickname was Swamp Yankee. And I didn't realize back then that he had planted a seed in me, right? So, you know, I was like addicted to words, right? He could make you laugh, cry. I couldn't tell the difference between fact and fiction, and I didn't care, right? He was a master storyteller. But he never put pen to paper. And back then, for me, that was like the dream, right? And then you grow up and, you know, kind of life sets in. And so I finished high school. I ended up joining the Army National Guard, military police. I was trained down in Alabama, came back. And I worked in the prison system in Massachusetts for almost 10 years and 5 years in the capacity of an investigator. So very, very negative time in my life because of, you know, that type of work.
Yeah.
The people that I work with were phenomenal, right? And I do whatever I can to bring respect and recognition to the profession because it's kind of concealed behind a wall. But what it did is it kind of spun me. So in 1990, we were activated and we ended up in Operation Desert Storm. Mm. And I was a squad leader at the time. I held the rank of sergeant. And to make a long story short, you know, Saddam Hussein said it would take us 6 months to get through the breach. It literally took minutes for us to get through. And the carnage was, you know, pretty incredible. My job was to collect enemy prisoners of war, or EPWs. Mm-hmm. I can honestly tell you for the first 3 days, we didn't find anything. I mean, it was pretty brutal. Mm. And it kind of changed me. I was 23 years old at the time, and that's considered almost an old man, right, in the Army, because you're dealing with kids that are, you know, 18, 19 years old.
Wow. But
I ended up flipping a Humvee. We were coming from Iraq down into Saudi Arabia, myself and my platoon sergeant. And this is the turning point in my life, Kelly, right, where – you know, I'm driving. We ended up hitting a dust storm, and they kind of cut the roads in the shape of a snake, right? So that you don't get hit. If you're in a convoy, like, you know, you can't get hit, you know, one after the other. They call it plinking, where the aircraft will come over and jack everybody. So, you know, they kind of cut the roads in the shape of a snake. We ended up hitting a dust storm, and lo and behold, I'm doing about 60 miles an hour, and I'm trying to get out of Iraq into Saudi, because as the sun's going down, the Republican Guard are coming out at night, and they're doing the same thing we were doing, you know, which is hunting for enemies. So I hit a boulder with the right front tire, ended up spinning this thing like a top, end over end. The driver's side got crushed. I got thrown out. Very long story short, and this is really why I'm a man of faith today, right? And I believe that none of us is ever alone, but my platoon sergeant was knocked out cold. So I treated him for shock. Couldn't call anybody on the radio because the roof had been crushed and the antenna was buried. And I sat there for about 3 hours in that desert. And it was the first time I'd ever felt alone. And, you know, I'd worked in a prison, so it takes a lot for me to be afraid of something, right? But I was reduced to really a 5-year-old kid who had lost his parents in the mall. And I remember thinking at that point, not if, but when I get home, life's too short, right? So when I get home, I'm going to chase my dream down and I'm going to become a published writer.
Wow.
You know, I want to be a writer. I want to be a published author. And that was the turning point. So the lowest part in my life ends up becoming, you know, the greatest inspiration for me to really take hold of my life and take responsibility for every action, every reaction, You know, there's nothing worse than a walking victim, right? So for me, you know, I could have dwelled back in there, and, you know, PTSD is very real. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to heal from that stuff. But, you know, it took me about 5 years to really heal from it emotionally, spiritually. But once I got my feet back under me, I've spent the last 30 years keeping that promise to myself.
Wow. So there's a lot to unpack there.
Right.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's incredible to hear just sort of how that moment was so significant. It sort of put things in perspective for you in that, right. You know, like you said, it wasn't a matter of if, but it was when I got home.
Right.
Like the way that it's almost like you were to use sort of a Christian terminology, you had a rebirth experience at Absolutely. That desert.
Absolutely.
Like life came into full perspective for you at 23 years old.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
a blessing.
Yeah.
An absolute blessing. Yeah.
When I was 23, I can't say that I had that sort of life.
Right. I get you. Yeah. So, believe me, I get you.
You know,
it was just, you know, but to suffer that type of trauma, and then I had to conceal it because I was a squad leader and I didn't want to, you know, have my people carry that weight as well. Mm-hmm. But I knew something had changed inside of me, and really, and I think the word is, and I tried to teach my kids this, we have four children that we've raised, and it's all about accountability, right? It's like, you know, you can point fingers, but pointing fingers outside of yourself is never, ever going to get you anywhere. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's really about accountability. So once I really took responsibility for everything that happens in my world, mm-hmm. then everything changed, man. Then it could become, all right, so if I do this or I do A, B, and C, then maybe I can get the D, and, you know, but it's on me. It's on my back, right? So I take probably the most pride in that, having, you know,
yeah,
marched that, you know, that road.
So I definitely want to get to you being an author and writing the book and just sort of talking about that. But I think it's important to pause and explore a little bit, because you're someone who has lived that, you know, you've lived a very traumatic, I mean, you're only in the second decade of your existence, and right. and you've gone through all of the experiences that you just outlined. And I'm sure that's just the tip of the iceberg, you know, but that right. moment is just so significant. Right. The trauma that you said that you kept hidden for a while, that PTSD, how were you able to deal with that once you got back home?
It was a great question, and it was probably more difficult to come home than to leave. And what I mean by that is, you know, things change. They change externally, but they also change inside of you. I knew that life was never going to be the same. At that time, I was, you know, married to my first wife. We had a house together. Mm-hmm. You know, even a sergeant's pay, if you look at the hours that we work, it's probably about $4 an hour. It was crazy, right? Wow. And I had a ton of overhead, and I was worried sick about it. But what happened is, you know, given all the stuff that we had experienced and witnessed, it changed me. It actually put me in a different place where, and to give you an example, Kelly, right? You know, you get home and you look at the grass and I'm like, yeah, the grass needs to be cut. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not a laziness thing. It's just, I need to heal. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't, you know, I knew who I was when I was 8 years old, lying in the grass and looking up at the clouds and dreaming about the life I'd have. And then I was reduced to somebody that I didn't know, right? Because I was traumatized and, you know, I was a professional soldier and it was my job, you know, to complete the mission, regardless of what that mission was. So, it took me again about 5 years to return. But what happened within those 5 years is I ended up losing my home, my profession, my chosen profession, law enforcement. I didn't retire. I actually resigned because to me it was the most honorable thing I could do. Mm-hmm. But I also knew I couldn't heal. And, you know, years ago, I would have never admitted to this, but, you know, I was in therapy in the VA hospital and, you know, my therapist was phenomenal. He was a Vietnam vet. And he would actually chuckle, like in a very professional way, but he'd chuckle at me like, I don't know how you can't heal from this, right? When I'm going to work every day and, you know, guys are hanging themselves and we're getting into these brutal fights. Mm. So I had to walk away from corrections. One of the most difficult things I've ever done, right? Because I really love the people and the camaraderie. But by doing that, it was like pushing the first domino. You know, I lost my house, my job. I ended up, the marriage ended up failing. Mm. And I actually had to reinvent myself. Mm-hmm. And then I figured, you know, if I'm going to fail again, at least let me fail at something that I love.
Yeah.
I
mean? Yeah.
And I just went after it fully. And a lot of it too, we have a son together And it was about teaching him how to stand up. You know what I mean? And be, and I hate to say be a man, right? Because it's kind of a cliche and he's got some stereotypes.
Sure, but, sure.
But be a stand-up person, right? Like get up and, you know what I mean? It's not, you're going to get knocked down, but you have to get up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's, in short, that's what life is, right?
Right.
That's what life is all about. And, you know, in recent years, I've just become more empathetic towards people who have been knocked down, but for whatever circumstances, they just right. can't get up. And, you know, so right. they end up committing suicide. They end up making really poor right. decisions that lead in very catastrophic or to very catastrophic results. And so
right.
From an outsider's perspective, to be able to see someone like that, it's easy to say, oh, come on, man, like it's bad, but there's always something worse. But you don't really know
right.
the
right.
intricacies of what led right. the person to that point.
Right.
And there are so many things that don't get addressed, that don't get spoken about, particularly, I think, within our gender as men.
Yes.
You know, you've lived longer than I've lived, so I'm sure you've been able to see the transition of how masculinity was thought of and spoken about right. when you were a teenager, when you were about my age. Now it's a little bit more open where
right.
Men are encouraged to share and talk and all of that. But it's still such a very difficult thing because it's ingrained in the culture that it's fine. Like, come on.
Right.
You know, like
right.
you said, be a man. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Just
right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I'll tell you what, to kind of expound on that, I raised two sons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if one of my boys is crying because he's skinned his knee, right? I'm going to get after him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come on. You know what I mean? But if he's brokenhearted for some reason, what I told him was, listen, the same heart that allowed me to stand up and defend people that couldn't defend themselves is that same heart that makes me cry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I know, like what some people see as weakness, I see as strength now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some of my better friends, and you know how it is, Kelly, right? You spend years and years trying to surround yourself with the right people,
yeah.
right? So you can live the right life.
Yeah.
And I have some of those friends now where I'm the furthest. I mean, I've never backed down from a fight in my life, you know what I mean? But I have no problem crying.
Yeah.
And I have no problem crying while I write. And I share that with my boys.
Mm.
And I'm like, listen, you know, I consider myself to some degree an empath, right? But even when I wrote this new book, Dad, it was so important for me to show that, hey, listen, we have the same feelings.
Yeah.
You know, a mother's love is a mother's love. Nobody's ever going to take that away.
Sure.
Right?
But yeah.
A father's love is a father's love.
For sure.
I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
And to the soul, right? Right to the marrow of your bones. So that's what I really wanted to depict. And that's the stuff I talk about. Because the last thing you want to be called, right, is a crybaby, but I'm not a weak man, and I feel very comfortable in my own skin, and it's taken me a long time to get here, right? So I'm more than thrilled to share that and to show all my children, you know, my daughters as well, that step up. You know what I mean? Like, stand up, step up, and, you know, this is what it's about. I'm only going to get one shot at this, so
yeah.
I need to do it the right way for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no, that is very well said. So you say you and your wife have raised four children.
Four children, yeah.
How long have you been married for?
We've been married for 12 years. This is the second time around. She's phenomenal, right? So this is my partner. She's, you know, it's amazing. She's a principal for an elementary school. And I think we found each other at the right time. So we brought these two families together and mm-hmm. kind of did the whole Brady Bunch thing, right? But, you know, love is a given, respect is earned, and, you know, hopefully we did the right thing. We made our mistakes with the kids, right? But hopefully we did more good things than bad, right? And you do the best you can do.
You know, I'm only a father for going on 15 months now. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm quickly realizing that when it comes to the issue of making mistakes, like, that's going to happen.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. The same way your parents made mistakes.
Exactly. You know,
right.
It's going to happen. It's a matter of how those mistakes are handled and the lessons
right.
that can be learned from them in order to prevent the same mistake from happening again or in order
sure.
to prevent a similar mistake from happening in the future.
Right.
But that's not a perspective that one gains unless you become a parent.
Yeah, you have to, right. You have to live it. Yeah. It's like when you're a kid, right? And they're like, oh, you're not going to know what that love is, right? Until you have one. And
yeah.
You're like, yeah, whatever. And then you have one and you're like,
whoa. Yeah.
Yeah, what I wouldn't do for this little person. You know what I mean? It's crazy.
So let's go back to that moment in your life, your first child. Can you recall what that moment was like for you?
It was, again, absolutely life-changing. So the best way for me to describe it is there was a piece of me that went away when he was born, right? Mm. So that ego part where, you know, the world kind of surrounds me, right? I'm the center of the universe, at least for my universe. Mm-hmm. Not anymore. Now it's his universe, right? So, and I'm going to do whatever I can for him to provide and defend and protect, and you can go on and on and on. But it was the first time I can honestly say unconditionally that somebody came before myself, mm-hmm. and I'm not a selfish person, but really became, you know, came before me mm-hmm. at every turn. It didn't matter what it was. You know what I mean? And I loved, my grandfather had a saying, and I love the saying, but it's, if you help somebody dig themselves out of their troubles, you find a place to bury your own, right? Mm. And that kind of has a negative connotation. So, you find somebody who's in trouble, you dive into their quote unquote crap, right? Mm-hmm. And then you forget about your own. Mm-hmm. I almost see fatherhood the same way where I can worry about all the little things, you know what I mean? Like the neighbors and this is going on, that's it. Or I can dive, headlong right into this kid's life mm-hmm. and be that, not just a participant, but to be that interactive, right? Where my job, everything is like, there was a time there, Kelly, where I was just seeking out these, teaching opportunities.
Yeah.
And for all my father didn't get right.
Yeah.
Right. Like my father wasn't perfect, but he was perfect for me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be that perfect father for my child, regardless of what that was. And I think the one thing that really sustained our relationship was truth. Mm. So it was never, I've apologized to him. Mm-hmm. I've told him I've been wrong. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think it's in that truth where my old man's got my back. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it's about.
Now, at what phase in your life were you when you first became a dad? Were you still in the military then?
Yeah, I was 25, so I had just gotten past that. But, I mean, he was born at a time where I was suffering and trying to get past the PTSD.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
First couple of years were difficult. And as I told you, the marriage failed, so I became a single dad.
Yeah.
We went to family court, and those words should never be put together, right? Mm. But we ended up going to family court in Massachusetts. And I had to fight to remain in his life. So I don't want to call it volunteer work because it gives the wrong impression, but I speak quite often at single dad groups, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Where I say, hey, listen, I feel your pain. It's going to go a lot faster than you think it is, right? And even if you're fighting with, your ex-wife, your ex-girlfriend, the kid comes first. And like, yeah, I know. I don't know. The kid comes first.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if you get beat up every time, that kid has to come first. And in the end, they're not stupid, right? They know exactly what you did or didn't do. Mm. You know what I mean? So important lessons there. But yeah, it was difficult for a while. It was just him and I for a while.
Yeah.
And I think part of it was just, he helped me heal too, right? He healed my soul.
I'm curious if you can say a little bit more about that. In what way can you say that he helped that healing process?
Because he was unconditional love, right? Mm. And every once in a while, I don't care who you are, you question your worth, right? And I found all of my worth. I found my purpose in him. You know what I mean? And it wasn't really he was very young, right? But it was him and I. I wasn't alone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he needed me. And it was having that one person that needs you that will, float you or sustain you for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
And listen, even if everything else in my world is going wrong, he's going to go right.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because you saying that phrase again, you weren't alone. Just flash back to that moment right. in the desert where you felt right. the most alone. So right. to be able yeah. to have that come full circle, so to speak, now with this human being that you're caring for, forcing right. you to live outside of yourself, giving you a sense of something that I'm going to guess at that point you had been missing or at least struggling with.
Right. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's beautiful, man.
Yeah. I was stuck in that. Right. I mean, you think about, and this is, something that really breaks my heart is I look at veterans, right, that have served our country mm-hmm. and some of them get locked into that time and place. And I remember praying. I'm a man of faith, so I would pray, please, God, don't let me be locked into 1991 where this becomes my life. Mm-hmm. And, this little boy made sure that didn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, you had no choice.
right. You go to the playground. He does not care about you know, dad's having, you know, had some nightmares the night before, whatever. Like, it's, you know, let's go get some ice cream.
Yeah, yeah.
So he healed me. And he healed me because he reminded me of innocence and goodness and, you know what I mean, this purity in children. So I had lost that. I was working in a prison. I mean, I was, walking some real dark shadows at the time. And I really do use the word courage, right? Because people say, well, you know, he quit working in the prison. I didn't quit. I regained my life. You know what I mean? Like at that point, there was way too much negativity and darkness. So it took more courage for me to walk away from a job that I was incredibly successful at. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, walking my way up the ladder. So that took a lot of courage, but I think he helped me again. If I had stayed where I was in that dark place, I would have never, ever been the father that I was to him. And then I continue to be for him.
Wow. No, that is well said. Because again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. From an outsider's perspective, you can see someone make a choice that without understanding any context, it's easy for the outsider to say, oh, come on, man, that's such a waste, you know, such a whatever other pejorative thing that the person can say at that moment. But you don't understand the reasons, the intricacies, the dynamics that led the person to make that decision. So whereas in my perspective, you know, a 5-6 figure job would be a goal for me, and you actually have that job, but you say, the heck with it. Like, I need to regain myself. And I would say, Steve, you're dumb. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
You know, for you, you've actually gained more than what I would gain if I were to get that job.
Right. Absolutely. And I'll tell you a prime example, Kelly, right? We recently had a reunion, and some of the people that I work with that I have, you know, the utmost respect for, it's not easy to work behind the walls. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, an investigator. It was, you know, 1,400 inmates in the population. This was a difficult place to go to every day. And I took great pride in wearing the uniform. Mm-hmm. Right? And I had excelled in certain areas. We went to the reunion, and I had people come up to me and say, you know, with all this success with the books, I get it. I get it. Now I understand why you left corrections. And I laugh because they still don't get it. If you got it, I would show you a picture of a 3-year-old boy. And that's the reason I left corrections. It wasn't to gain success through writing. That just ended up becoming a byproduct, right, of kind of cleansing my soul and getting back to that 8-year-old kid who used to daydream.
Yeah. Right?
And that's who I am.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope that what you're saying resonates with people who are listening to this, who may find themselves in a similar place than you were,
right,
and be able to exercise that word, courage, to do what seems counterintuitive, without really understanding, you know, what the next step might be, but right here, right now, the price to be gained is yourself.
Absolutely. And the future and the legacy, and it goes on and on. I within my books, there's always that underlying, you know, you're never alone. Obviously, you picked up on that theme, right? But, and it's also, it's about love. And it's like, I really, truly believe we only get one shot at this. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think about like my kids, right? As they started to grow up, and I would tell them, listen, everything starts as a wish, right? You can be anything you want to be. And I truly believe that. Mm-hmm. You want to be an astronaut, you can be an astronaut. Mm-hmm. But what does it take to be an astronaut?
Yeah.
It takes work, man. Work and work and work and grind and grind. And even then, it's just to try to get to that opportunity.
Yeah.
So my thing with them was like, you know, you never get you don't always get what you wish for, but you always get what you work for. So go get it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think the last time we talked, I told you, one of the greatest gifts I ever gave my children is I failed for nearly 20 years.
Mm.
Right. At this craft, which, you know, the writing industry is brutal. So the rejection rate, you know, hovers around 97%. So they watched me for years and years pound out these books and hit it. And, you know, what's going on, Dad? Right. And it's, you know, you're failing here, you're failing there. And the whole time what I'm doing is actually honing my skills and my craft.
Yeah.
And now they look at it and they laugh.
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know what I mean? Of course. I wasn't going to leave the table until I got that winning hand, right?
Yeah.
But I had to earn it.
Sure.
I had to earn it.
So you've spoken a little bit about being a father. You mentioned your grandfather, and so we can talk about the influence that he has had on you as the conversation goes on. But right now, you recently, I don't know how recent, but you're at a new phase in life where you've graduated from dad to grandpa.
Yeah, one of the greatest gifts in life, absolutely. Yeah, you can spoil them and then hand them back, right? So now I cannot wait to play such an active role in this little girl's life. So she was born early, about 5 weeks early. Her name's River Isabel. Mm. Just a beautiful little, you know, just a little angel, right? I couldn't be more happy, my wife and I. But even that, like, you know, a few years ago, if you told me, hey, you're going to be a grandpa, right, at 53 years old, I'd be like, oh, my, you know. And now I embrace it, man. Yeah. I just embrace it because, again, it's a priority thing, right? So when I look at the pecking order, I don't see myself at the top. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I'll tell her the same thing I've told my children, right? I got you. I'm in your corner, right? And they're like, yeah, Dad. And I'm like, no, listen to me. I got you. Mm-hmm. And I want her to know that. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The old man's got my back, regardless of what it is.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure things are, in terms of the way you relate to your granddaughter, I'm sure it's very different to the way that you relate, that you related with your children when you were their father, and especially now that your child is now a parent, or herself, it's a different, it changes the dynamic a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the roles and responsibilities, the expectations, you know, and I'll go back to one generation before that. So my dad passed 2 years ago, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that, mm-hmm. but when my son Evan was born, my father raised me and two brothers, and then years later they had two girls. So same parents, almost really kind of wild, like 16 years apart, right? Mm-hmm. These two families. But my old man was tough, man. He was heavy-handed when we came up with, you know, three maniacs. Yeah. It was just crazy. But again, he was the perfect father for us. Yeah. And at that time, you know, that's what they did. So there was always, I don't want to say resentment or animosity, but there was always that feeling like, you know, the old man, he could be tough.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
My kid's born and he thinks my father walks on water. Right? Grandpa walked on water. I'm like, you don't know him. Right. And then I remember my grandfather who walked on water for me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you hear these stories that I don't even want to hear that make him human. Yeah. Oh, your grandfather did this. He said that. I don't even want to hear it. Right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
That man was an angel. Yeah. Right? Yeah. So for my kids, my father and my father-in-law, they played those roles.
Yeah.
And I think, wow, how cool. How cool is that, right? To be placed up there, right, where these kids see you, right, as being the, you know, the patriarch of the family and having that type of respect and love. So it's a gift, man. It's been a blessing, absolute blessing.
So let's start diving a little bit into sort of just how all of your life experiences, you know, you alluded to this earlier, led you to this place of chasing your dream once you got out of that desert. So you're out of that desert. You said that you were at the table for 20 years trying to play, you know, your best hand and doing the best with what you were giving until that breakthrough happened.
Yeah.
And so that breakthrough happens. Take it away from there.
Yeah. So the breakthrough happens and I end up meeting a guy by the name of Lou Aronica who you know, spent his career as a publisher, editor-in-chief in for Bantam Dell. Like he was in New York with the big conglomerates, mm-hmm. right? When Avenue of the Americas was, you know, that was it. Now we got like five major publishing houses.
But, yeah.
And long story short, he ends up opening up his boutique shop, right? And I go knock on his door, right? And I said, hey, listen, I'm an author. He said, well, I'm not really looking for an author right now. What I am looking for is a copy editor. So I said, well, I'm also a copy editor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's going to see this and laugh, but I'm not a copy editor, right? I just want to keep this conversation going. So he ends up hiring me. I think at the time, maybe industry standard was like $3, right? For a double space page. I charge him $2.
Okay.
I then spend probably 10 times the amount on this manuscript that any copy editor would have, but I had to get it right. Mm-hmm. I get it back to him. Hey, great job, Steve. I said, by the way, I'm an author. He said, yeah, I'm just not. I do another copy. Almost 2 years goes by. Mm-hmm. He finally comes to me and he says, listen, I'm not looking for one book. I'm looking to cultivate authors, right? Because they put so much time and effort into you once they get you to a certain point. Mm-hmm. You know, it would need to be more than one book. So I said, I have 5 manuscripts sitting up on a shelf. And I knew, honestly, Kelly, like I knew maybe edit probably rewrite.
Okay.
But I need them. I need that right mentor. I need somebody to show me how to make my stuff commercial.
Yeah. You know?
And this was the guy, man. And it was unbelievable. And I told him, I'm not sure I'll ever be your show pony, right? But I am a workhorse. And I kept my word on that. Mm-hmm. So I've made every deadline. I've done everything. And in turn, this man is absolutely brilliant, right? So in turn, he's kept his word on everything. And we recently just signed a master contract, and I'll be working with him for years to come. So
there you go.
What he did is he kind of broke me out, you know, and I was a local success. And then you start to go national and then international. But the one thing that hasn't changed for me is the work, right?
Yeah.
And, there's certain people I admire. Like I really admire Dwayne Johnson, right? The Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he says is every room I walk into, nobody will outwork me.
Mm-hmm.
And I take that on as a writer, right? So I go to conferences, workshops, and there'll people that come up to me. And what they don't realize is when you look at the whole trajectory of a writing career,
mm-hmm.
there's people that are super successful that are about 2 inches away from where I am, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's people that are behind me that are only a couple inches behind me, mm-hmm. right? In the bigger scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell them, you know, when we sit down and I teach or I try to share, we always do it in a circle, right? I'm also a writer. So it's not about, oh, he's a best-selling author. No, I'm a writer, mm-hmm. right? You're a writer, so let's talk writing.
Mm-hmm.
But what I tell people, and I tease them, I said, there's nobody in this room that'll outwork me.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. Because it means that much to me, right? It's, for me, it's, you know, in the beginning, it was all about perseverance, mm-hmm. right? So that's what sustained you for the 20 years. Then it becomes purpose,
mm-hmm.
and it's my passion, right? So when you put them all together, I'm excited to get up in the morning, right? If I'm going to go downstairs and write, you know what I mean?
Perseverance, so, purpose, and passion.
Yeah, the three P's for me. And I'll tell you, perseverance is the key to it. And I wrote a book years ago called The Author's Toolbox, and it was to help, you know, young or aspiring writers, not about age, just people getting started.
Mm-hmm.
And what I tell them is this, the five major things that you need to do to be a successful writer. And it's the first is to write the best you can, you know, write, right? It's got to be impeccable, right? Flawless.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is perseverance. The third thing is perseverance. The fourth thing is perseverance. Because it's all about, you know, do you believe enough in yourself to stay at the table?
Mm-hmm.
If the rejection rate is 97%, you can either think about that or you can think, man, I'm going to be part of the 3%.
Yeah,
you
know for I mean? Sure.
And work toward that.
Yeah.
Right? So it's all about attitude. It really is.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about the newest book that is coming out in September and where you came up with the concept and how does your life experiences play into the composition of the book?
So Data Novel, it was actually supposed to come out August 17th because of COVID and all the supply chains. I mean, they literally, the printer couldn't get the paper. It's sitting in a Connex container. So it got kicked out a month. So we wait like everybody else in the world, right? And I'm a patient man. But I'm super excited about it. And the reason for it is 2 years ago, my father passed. And my sister, as you know, as I just told you, right, this one is 21 years younger than I am.
Okay.
So their kids are really small, right? So they're just starting to have their families. She's pregnant. My dad gets sick. My dad tells her, I'm not going anywhere until the baby's born.
Hmm.
The baby's born at Charlton Memorial Hospital in Fall River, Massachusetts. On the third floor, my father's on the first floor in the ICU. He passes away 5 hours later.
After the baby was born. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, Kelly, I'm going to try not to get emotional, but I held his hand as he left.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I left, you know, I made a promise, right, that I was going to honor him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and thank him. And this book is a big part of that. This book is me saying thank you.
Wow. Sorry about your father passing.
Ah, thank you.
I worked as a hospice chaplain for a couple of months, some years back. And one of the most transformative things that came out of that experience is to be in the presence of people who knew they were going to go,
right,
almost to a science.
Wow.
almost to a science, and it didn't happen. I mean, it happened often because hospice is, you know, I think one of the gifts of hospice is to have the person transition in a setting that is conducive to them. So a lot of times they can be surrounded by family, what have you. It wasn't always the case.
Okay.
But just to be able to hear the person who is dying sort of review their own lives and however long they live, to be able to synthesize all of that into, you know, an hour or two or three of conversation and just give the best of the best juice of that fruit. I mean, that was just precious.
That's awesome, man.
You know, that was just precious. So for your dad to say something like that, I'm not going anywhere until the baby's born. You said that and I'm like, I'm thinking about it now and I'm having chills.
Right.
You know, that's special.
It's incredible, man. And I'll tell you, I, you know, being a man of faith, and I wouldn't consider myself a religious person, but I am a man of great faith. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote that book, Dad, I truly felt like he was sitting with me, like he was with me when I wrote it. Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, the purpose is kind of twofold. Usually when I write a book, I'm writing it for my kids, like my kids are the audience. Right. So mm-hmm. as long as I know that they'll be proud of me, right, the rest is a byproduct. So people, oh, I love the book, or I didn't really care for the book. Let me be honest, right?
I don't care.
All good. Like, it's all good either way. And don't get me wrong. I hope that it helps you. I hope that it helps us connect as humans. But if it doesn't, it doesn't, right? My kids are everything to me, right? So as long as I keep that. So that novel was twofold, where it was a love letter or a thank you letter to my father, mm-hmm. but also a love letter to my kids, mm-hmm. right? To say, this is what I see fatherhood as, right? So like my last name, and I've always kind of hammered this into them, right? I take great pride in my last name because my father had that name. Mm-hmm. My grandfather had my name mm-hmm. and his father had that name. So when I tell them, listen, don't be a knucklehead, right? Like, you know what I mean? Represent, because mm-hmm. in the end, even I don't care how many bestsellers I have, my kids are going to define what kind of man I was, right? So whoever they become will be
a reflection,
you know, evidence.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So the other stuff is just whatever. Right. So, and that's what I think when I'm out in the world and I'm, you know, working with other people, it's all about my father's name.
Yeah. Perspectives through which you are telling the story of Dad, a novel.
Yeah. So three generations of fatherhood. So the first one was an old timer, right? His name's Robert in the book. Finds out he has a terminal illness. So clearly, I hate to use the word layup, but kind of an easy ride. So this is me watching my father toward mm-hmm. the end of his life, mm-hmm. right? And we're all going to get there, right? We're all heading home at some point, yep. right? So I was blessed to be able to witness it and be there in his final moments. Second guy's name is Oliver. Typical midlife crisis. I'd like to believe I'm not in one right now, but you don't know. But I get it. So he's pivoting, right? He's between, you know, I got my father who's sick. He needs me, right? So I need to be, you know, that stand-up guy. Mm-hmm. And then his son, Jonah, in the book, 19, 20 years old, finds out that his girlfriend is pregnant. He's going to, you know, they're going to have a baby. Mm-hmm. So fatherhood in three very different phases. But the difficulty, or I should, it wasn't say the difficulty, the challenges of this book, Kelly, right, mm-hmm. was the complexities of weaving in and out, right? So if I bring, and as you know, right, I did it from each chapter is a different perspective. So the old man gets, you know, his say, mm-hmm. right? And all of the internal thoughts are from him. Then you get to the next chapter, and then it's his son, Oliver. Mm-hmm. So you kind of see like a you know, it's we're handing it off from Robert, but from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. So now it's the son looking at what the father thinks. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the grandson. But the way the grandfather talks to the grandson, he's not coddling him, right? Mm-hmm. It's like straight out, he's from a different generation. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are entitled. I had to walk uphill both ways to go to school, right?
Yeah.
So you got all that stuff that's going on. And then you got the father in the middle who's trying to be there and be all of that for both of them, right? So for me, this was the perfect time for me to write this book. Lou, who I had mentioned, Lou Aronica, my publisher, had actually come to me. We had a very honest conversation. Listen, not looking to exploit the emotions that you're feeling about your dad, but would you consider? And the answer is absolutely yes.
Yeah.
And it took a little bit more than a year to write this book, but I needed to get it right. And the most difficult write for me within the book mm-hmm. was Jonah. Because even though I have sons, I'm far removed from 19 years old, right? Yeah. I can relate more to the old timer than I can, you know, the kid that was running around without a real thought in his head, right?
Yeah.
So really had to do some research. I mean, even in the dialect, the way that he talks and speaks, and, you know, I spent some time with my kids, and then I realized they're a little bit past that too. So that, you know, it's crazy, man. Then you start hanging around younger people, and I'm like, just listening to the way they talk and, you know, how some of their choices could impact their lives without them even knowing it, right? So
yeah.
It was a joy to write it. It was very emotional to write it. But again, you know, being comfortable in my own skin. And I think having spent all those years, right, with the, you know, pen and paper, I finally have the skill set to pull it off.
How cathartic was it for you to complete, or not even complete, but during the process of this project?
Right.
Yeah. How cathartic was that?
It was definitely healing, man, because it was, you know, grieving the loss of somebody, right? I don't believe, like, at any point, I don't know, people talk about time. Like, for me, it's just learning to live with that grief, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's still a huge hole in my life without my dad here, right? So for me, I go to a spiritual realm where, okay, he's still with me. I can't see him. It's not a tangible thing, but he's there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I need to be fully present for my kids and now my granddaughter, mm-hmm. you know, so, and obviously my wife. But it was very healing. It was a way for me to, again, say thank you to him, but grieve, and I think in a very healthy way, right?
Yeah.
And I was able to be able to share that with people, because I think what I'm excited about from this book is it's not just the dad. Like, you know, you see, well, Father's Day comes around, you buy the book, you know, you give it to your grandson gives it to you mm-hmm. or whatever, right? That's part of it. But part of it is the whole female element where my wife doesn't, you know, my daughter and my wife have this relationship I'm never going to pretend to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Like the complexity, the arguing, like, that's just, the best thing I can do is, you know, when the Giants are fighting, I stay out of the high.
Get
match,
out the right? way, yeah.
Exactly. So for me and my sons, there's things that they don't get.
Yeah.
Right? There's things that they don't get. So I wanted to kind of peel back the curtain a little bit. Here's a little insight. Just because I'm barking doesn't mean I'm not bleeding inside, right?
Yeah.
And that it's killing me.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to teach this kid, hey, listen, this is how you got to do it. Because someday, you know, the old man's not going to be around, right?
Yeah.
And we need to teach, you know, there's that saying where, you know, it's our job to raise them, not to keep them.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult when you get to this point where it's like, right, I did everything I could, so you need to go. So for me, dad and novel is like, goodbye, dad. Here's my kids,
yeah.
right? Like, now you're getting to an age where, you know, they may be, you know, marching up on parenthood. One of them already has. So
yeah,
perfect timing. Absolute perfect timing.
It's clear from our conversation so far that the characters, the perspectives that drive forward this book, I mean, you're intimately connected with them because
yeah, absolutely,
like, these are three facets of who you are as a person right. yourself. And so you're exploring yourself in a threefold way
right.
and sort of teasing them out to put absolutely. Together this book.
Right.
I remember when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you said it took you, like, you completed this book in a year, you said, but it's taken you like 30 something years to
to write it. Absolutely. The whole time. And I think that's probably true for most books. Like, I write reality based fiction. The funny thing is, and I may have shared this story with you, but, you know, I've sat in conferences with 200, I was a keynote speaker, and I'm sitting there, there's 250 people in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
248 are women. It's me and this other guy who looks lost in the room, right? So they're like, so I turned to the lady on my left. I said, "Have you ever heard this guy speak?" And she says, "No." I said, "Oh my God, he's terrible." And she said, "Are you kidding me?" I said, "He's absolutely awful." And they had to pay for the lunch and for the speaker. So when I get up to the podium and I turn around, she starts laughing. But I'm 6 feet tall, right? I weigh 240. I have a background in law enforcement in the military, and I write tearjerkers. I write male perspective to a female audience. It's insane. It's insane to me. You know what I mean? So what's so cool about it is I can write from a male perspective, but with some empathy, right? So my thing is, okay, mom, okay, wife, okay, daughter, come take a look at our world, right? And let me pull back the curtain between a father and a son, or a son and his father, a son and a grandfather, mm-hmm. you know, at different stages. Not an easy ride. And this wasn't linear either. I didn't start at point A and finish at point Z. This was like putting a puzzle together.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really was.
So, man, there's this question that I want to ask, but I want to make sure that I am formulating the thoughts in my head correctly so that I don't confuse you. But the book is exploring fatherhood from three different perspectives. From that of a grandfather, from that of the 19-year-old, and from that of his father who's watching him become a father, and then the grandfather who's watching his son. Yeah, I mean,
exactly. Exactly.
So that dynamic in itself to me is so very fascinating. Just because, you know, like I said, I'm only a father for 15 months, and I can already tell that fatherhood is not a static thing. It unfolds, it grows, it develops, you build on it, and it takes on a different flavor and a different facet at different points of your life. You know, I'm not the same father that I was 15 months ago today. So, so how have you been able to, that's not even the question I want to ask. The question I want to ask is how would you define what fatherhood is from all three of those perspectives? So if you were to ask the grandpa and the grandson and the, how would they define what fatherhood is?
I think in the beginning, panic, right? So for Jonah, it's panic, right? So, you know, he still needs to finish his education. He hasn't found the right job. Money is going to be an issue, right? The one thing he has over the other two is energy, right? So, boundless, which is why young people have little babies, right?
Yeah.
They get the energy to do it, right? The second guy, I think, is probably in the worst position, right? Because even though he has the benefit of his experience in his past, everything has significantly changed. So that's where I'm at in my life, right?
Yeah.
When I look down the road, it's kind of, you know, I can see where my father ended up, but it was from this point to where that point is, where I'm like, oh man, like that's still uncharted water, right? Mm-hmm. So things changed for me. You know, I went from having to provide everything to, hey, Dad, I need a ride. Oh, by the way, I got my license.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Dad, can I borrow 20? You know what I mean? Yeah. It becomes that type of, where I play a very different role in their lives, right?
Yeah.
So, but you also contend with other things. So, you know, now we're looking at retirement, right? Am I ready for that? So there's things that, it's like, oh my, you know, it's just a, I don't want to say a difficult, but a challenging time in life.
Yeah,
right?
A lot of transitions, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the old man is my favorite character in the book, right? Even though I relate most to Oliver, the middle-aged guy. I love the old man because he's finally learned to get out of his own way, right?
Mm.
So he just kind of shakes his head, right? And it's like, it's all going to be good. It's all going to be okay. Like everything's going to be okay. No matter what you do or say, it's going to be okay. You cannot imagine the mistakes that I've made and look how you turned out.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's all good, man. Relax. You know what I mean? It's all about love and just be there. Be there, be there, be there. If you can't do anything else, be there.
Yeah.
And that's, and hopefully that's the message in the book where even he tells Jonah, you're going to screw it all up. And there's no manual for this. You are going to screw this up.
Yeah.
Babe. I did, right? Be there. Make sure the kid knows that you are there, that he, you know, he or she is priority one. And I think that's the gift in the book.
Yeah. I mean, I can so relate to the panic mode.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, it was a total panic. And, you know, I became a father at 35, so a little more mature than the character in the book. But still, it was, that's my first child.
Sure. Brand new.
What the hell are we doing here?
Right, exactly.
You know, like how do we figure this out? Like this kid is crying. Like what do I do? You know, I can do if I talk to him, he can't answer. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So
exactly.
in terms of like the job and the education, you know, I was I had solid job, completed my education, and so
awesome.
I didn't have that to worry about, but it's still the panic of
it is.
I have to keep this thing alive.
Right. It is. I think it's almost, you know, parenthood, I should say, right, is almost proof positive that God has a sense of humor, right?
Because for sure.
When have you ever picked up a job that important where you you've received zero training.
Zero.
You know what I mean? Like there's nothing. I mean, you can read books and this, but
yeah, but it's not the same thing.
No. And every kid's different, yeah. Right? So your child's much different from my child. The needs are different. So,
yes.
And it's just what I loved about it. And I continue to love about it. Is you have to die in order to be successful. If that's a word that you can even apply to parenthood, is you have to be all in, man. You've got to dive in and just, we're in this together, right? We're in the same boat. Let's start rowing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. You dealt with trauma and PTSD in your personal life.
Right.
Do you explore that through the perspective of any of the characters in the book at all? Not the same way, but some sort of like,
yeah, I do. I think with Oliver, he gets, you know what I mean? There's times in his life, like it's, and I almost wish I had written this in the book. And this is the worst part about writing books, right? Hmm. You finish a book and you're like, it's done. And I'm going to have, you know, 5 years from now, I'll have 5 more years experience.
Yeah.
I'm like, Kelly, I should have put this in. You know what I mean? But I think what happens is, you know, in any relationship, and I recently had a talk with a friend about this where, you know, something's failing in your life, right? But it's not the whole, right? So it's like, so we focus on that. And then you'll start to panic, right? So even, I mean, you're getting your panic attacks, anxiety, whatever you want to call it, but because there's something that's really, really wrong and I don't know how to fix it, right? Maybe it can't even be fixed, right? But and you just laser focus on that one thing where the rest of the tree is healthy, right? So the whole is phenomenal, but it's that one thing. And I think with the midlife crisis, I didn't put it in those words, but I hope I got that across where he needs to, it's about perspective. So he needs to shift his perspective on, hey, listen, even though the kids don't need me anymore, I'm still their dad. And eventually I'm going to become a grandfather, right? So I play a very important role in this family, but I get it, right? There's a certain panic where I call it in the wind. So my kids are in the wind, right? You went to school, you're good. Now you're living in your own place. You got your own job.
Yeah.
Hey, Pop, you know, maybe we can get together for dinner next week. What do you mean, maybe? You know what I mean? Like, it's that type of thing. We have one last one who's going to be a senior in high school, and then she's off to college, right? So for my wife and I, it's about adjusting and transitioning. And there is a level of panic with that, too. Now it's like, you know, now I have to redefine myself again. What kind of purpose or role do I play within the family, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you call it PTSD, but there's some trauma involved. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you know, you're talking about that and I'm realizing that the common denominator between those three phases is this constant adjustment and readjustment.
Absolutely.
And it's that insane. Never goes right. away.
Oh.
You know, the old man is still transitioning now that he is going to become a great grandfather.
Right.
Right. And so that's a different dynamic.
Right.
The middle-aged guy is going through whatever.
A lot.
Right. Yeah, you know, he's going through a lot.
The job's not great. The marriage is not great. I mean, it's a tough time.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to put out any stereotypes on that, you know, given his age and gender, but it just made sense for me to put him in those situations where, you know, he, again, every time he thinks about somebody other than himself, he's in a better place. You know what I mean? Like, again, a cliche, but the only constant is that change. It's everything's going to continue to change. It's never going to end.
Yeah.
And the one thing, you know, when our daughter had the baby, it's like surrender to the worry, right? And she just looks at you and smiles. Surrender to it. It's not going to end. Like little kids, little problems. Big kids, bigger problems, right? Yep. But by then, you've had the experience and the wherewithal where you can start to deal with that stuff. I'm pretty sure, you know, the day before my old man passed, he was worried about me. And my siblings, you know what I mean? Like he was, I don't know what you call it, worry or concern, or you know what I mean? Like that's part of the package. And to me, that's the price you pay for fatherhood or motherhood. You
know what I mean? Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think that's a very powerful thing that you just said, surrender to the worry.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty chill guy.
Right.
Until my son was born.
Right.
Because
it's that important.
It's that important. I mean, you know, if something went undone, okay, like whatever, it's all good, you know. I mean, I had a sense of responsibility to my wife, and so yeah, sure, but now this little life is depending on me, you know. And it's this, his arrival on the scene was like a mirror just sort of appearing before me continuously,
right.
And he made me examine who I was or who I am. He makes me do that on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's
you know,
awesome.
What kind of man are you? You know, how are you presenting yourself?
Right.
What is he learning from you? Even if you're not communicating in a way that, you know, is I don't want to say meaningful, because that would imply that just because he can't speak yet, we're not communicating, but we're, you know, but we can't have that adult exchange and interaction.
Right.
You know, but he's still like, what are you presenting to your son at this moment?
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
How is he perceiving you as a father right now?
Right.
And
right.
How are you shaping his concept of who he ought to be, or how he ought to be, or how he should be, you
right.
know, at this phase? And I mean, so just all of these, it's almost like this existential state that,
yeah.
that I'm in constantly. And you're right. It doesn't end. And, you know, that's just the one side of it. Then there's the other worry of his safety and all of that jazz, which is a totally different, but
right.
you're right. Just like surrender to the worry, because it's not going to go away. My sisters and I, we're all parents, and we all became parents sort of in our birth orders. First, my older sister, then me, then my younger sister.
Oh, wow.
And we all have sons.
That's cool.
And so they're all like, my oldest nephew is 1.5. You know, my son is 15 months, and then my younger nephew is going to be 4 months old. So boom, boom,
oh, that's
boom.
That's cool.
Yeah.
They're coming up together.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
awesome.
So boom, boom, boom. And so we're all in our 30s. My mom still worries about us as if we were 15.
Little kids, yeah, exactly.
And it's like, wait a minute, I'm an adult, for crying
right.
out loud. But is this common denominator of transitions? Because as my life is transitioning, so is her life, you
right.
know? And so it's definitely like, this conversation is definitely preparing me to keep that in mind as my son gets older and we go through more transitions in life. So how have you personally, you know, outside of the characters in the book, how have you personally been able to balance these transitions as they come along?
I think the older I get, the more I take things in stride. You know, like to your point, right? I think that, you know, if you're with the right woman, right, she makes you a better man. No two ways
100%.
About it, because you don't want to disappoint her, right?
100%.
With kids, you know, my question has always been, you know, as long as my children are never ashamed of me,
yeah,
I got to be doing something right, right?
Yeah.
I can be a good man, right?
yeah.
If I'm a good man in their eyes, and you know, because they're going to hold me to a standard that maybe some people won't.
Yeah,
you know what I
yeah.
mean? But I think the older I get, the more I take things in stride. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I know it's going to constantly change, and my wife and I have. You know, even with the new grandbaby, right? Things have you know, they're changing, they're transitioning.
Yeah.
You look at the way, even the way you see yourself,
yeah.
right? Now, you know, she's a bavoe, I'm a grandpa, right?
Yeah.
So it's different, you know what I mean? So, oh my God, now she's bavoe, I'm grandpa. But it's awesome, right? And it's just accepting that and saying, all right, that's, you know what I mean? Like, I'm never going to another nightclub, you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, where we're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure we'll worry about the baby too, right? And just surrender to that, because it's part of the, you know, the price you pay.
Yeah.
Right? So.
Conversation.
It's
a very, very rich conversation. And I just think it's so cool to be able to explore fatherhood from those three perspectives.
Right.
And yeah, it's, I mean, I have just so many things running through my head right now. It's,
I'll tell you, this has been an awesome, awesome conversation. Yeah. And I'll tell you, you're a gifted interviewer. I do this a lot. And I appreciate the way that you presented this, because it's, it hasn't even felt like an interview. It's just like a conversation between friends. So thank you for that.
I appreciate that. I'm going to ask you two more questions, and then
okay.
and then I'll let you go. The first question is, how do you, I would like you to assume the voice of the three main characters in your book.
Okay.
And talk to dads who are, who can relate to where these characters are in their lives presently.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So the first, and let me start from the top to the bottom.
Yeah. Right?
So the patriarch, Robert, gratitude,
mm-hmm.
right? Gratitude for everything that you had. I mean, like I, years ago, I wrote a book on, called The Rocking Chair. It was about an old man and an old lady, right? And they get to the end of their lives and you find out she has Alzheimer's and he is furious because they've spent their entire lives putting all these memories in a bank. And then when it came time to cash it in, she couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So he sits in this rocking chair on his porch, Kelly, right? And he decides, I'm going to remember for us both.
Mm.
So for me, it's about acceptance and getting to like different seasons of our lives, mm-hmm. right? So for Robert, he's in a season where he's accepted it with grace,
mm-hmm.
right? He's elderly. He's ill. It's time for him to go home and see his parents again, right? But before I go, let me make sure everybody knows how I feel about them, that I did the job to the best of my ability,
mm-hmm.
you know, failed over and over and over, made all these mistakes. But from a grandfather's, you know, perspective, I think it's that. Like, when I see my grandparents, all four of my grandparents, I see them in a totally different light from my parents, right? Because mm-hmm. the roles and expectations were different.
Mm-hmm.
And the love wasn't, it wasn't a stern love, right? It was, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I love Robert in the book because he takes things in stride. He's still got a sense of humor at a real difficult time in his life, but it's all about memories. And then imparting whatever it is that you really think is wisdom, those nuggets, right? And imparting them on people before you leave,
mm-hmm.
you know? For Oliver, it should be stride, but it's not, right? So that whole midlife deal where I think the more you know who you are, the easier it comes. I mean, I have friends that as soon as their kids go off to college or graduate from college, you know, they're cashing in, right? The house is up on the market,
yeah.
the marriage is done, this and that. And it's like, that's pretty terrible.
Yeah.
You know I mean, like you should have known long before or at least worked on that stuff long before. And I'm not passing judgment, but so for Oliver, it was about, you know, really knowing who you are and appreciating what you have.
Yeah.
So again, gratitude, right? But getting to a point where I may not know what's in front of me, but, you know, let's take this on as something that's exciting
right?
versus something that I'm dreading.
Yeah.
You know? And then the last guy, Jonah, right? He's a knucklehead, right? He's 19 years old, doesn't know anything about anything, right? And I think in his case, it's about faith, right? And, you know, that saying, hey, it's all going to be okay. You know, and I love when people post this stuff on social media. You know, if you were 18, what would you write to yourself if you were 18 years old, right? And it really comes about like, you're going to be fine. Like you're going to ride that coaster and you're going to hit some obstacles and stuff. And maybe even certain tragic things happen, but in the end, you're going to be fine.
Yeah. Right?
It's going to play out the way it should play out. Make the best choices you can. Right. For younger people, I tell them all the time, and I had written a book called The Changing Season, where if you make the wrong choice at the wrong time, you could jump tracks, right? Now you're in a different life, nothing that you had planned on. So try to keep your head out of your behind, right? And mm-hmm. do the best you can get until you get to a certain point where things become easier,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, but it was fun. It was kind of cool to write those different stages of, and not just as fathers, but as men or humans, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? To be at those different stages of their lives.
Thank you for that. The last thing I'm going to ask you to do is to speak to your children and your granddaughter. And if there could be one or two bits of wisdom
right.
that you would absolutely want them to have,
right.
What would you say to them? And in particular to your granddaughter who's just coming on into this world.
Right. Well, first and foremost, she's loved beyond anything she'll ever imagine, right? So whether or not she can process that cognitively, as long as she feels it, she's in a good place. She's surrounded by love, right? Shrouded in it. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's my message for her. But from my for all of my grandchildren, those who are even unborn, right? And my children, it's really about as quickly as you can get to a place where you're comfortable in your own skin, that's where you need to be.
Mm.
Stop worrying about what other people think. Take it on. I tell the kids all the time, right? If you can find what your passion is truly and turn that into your purpose, you're going to live a pretty cool life,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm not talking about financially or materialistically. Like, I'm talking about, you know, something from your soul, right? Mm-hmm. Where you look back on your life as Robert did and say, you know, was it worth the ride? Mm-hmm. Did I make the most out of all of it? Right. So again, you know, be who you are. You're unique. You were made, you know, don't try to be acting like somebody else. You are who you are. So be that person. Have the courage to be that person. And, you know what I mean? Go after what you love. Chase that dream down because it can come true. You're going to have to bust for it, but
yeah,
it can happen.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Man, Steve, thank you so much, man,
for the
time and conversation. This has been really beneficial and enriching to me. Thank you for that. Looking forward to the release of the book in September. So when is the book being released and where can
September 14th.
Okay. And where is it available?
Back a month. I don't, you know, I almost feel bad for the publisher because of the way the industry is right now. So, but I'm excited. I really am. I mean, we have some early reviews on it. People are really digging it. I love when, you know, women read it and they come back because again, it's that male perspective. Mm-hmm. But hopefully I've been able to, again, peel back that curtain just a hair so people can take a look. You know.
Where could people find the book?
Amazon. It'll be available essentially on Amazon. You can get it on Barnes & Noble, iBooks. But Amazon, you know, do better and differently, right? That's it now, right?
Yeah, that's the place to go.
That's the one-stop shop, right? So it'll come out in hardback. It's also going to come out in audio.
Okay.
I know that the voice actor is working on it right now. And it's going to come out in Kindle form.
Okay.
And then usually about 6 months down the road, Kelly, they'll put out a paperback version of the hardcover.
Okay. All right. So then it will be available in different formats for people to get their hands on it.
You won't be buying yours. I'll be sending you one. And I'm also going to be sending you a copy of another book called The Menu, which I really hope you enjoy.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah.